Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
If there's one thing that I've enjoyed most about doing these podcasts for the past year and a half, and we are up to our 79th episode, is that I get to learn a lot of things that I have absolutely no idea about. And that's the theme of today's show, helping me learn about some ancient Jewish manuscripts and the exciting story of how they were discovered. To cite the dust jacket of the book featured on today's show, this is a story where Indiana Jones meets the Da Vinci Code in an old Egyptian synagogue. Now, how cool is that? And the book that I'm referring to, the main focus of our discussion today, is entitled Sacred Treasure, The Cairo Geniza, The Amazing Discoveries of Forgotten Jewish History in an Egyptian Synagogue Attic, released by Jewish Lights Publishing. The author is Rabbi Mark Glickman, who heads two congregations here in Washington State, Kol Ami in Woodinville and Kol Shalom on Bainbridge Island. Rabbi Glickman is also a regular religion columnist for our hometown newspaper, the Seattle Times, and has been featured in other books and journals. But perhaps most importantly, he happens to be the husband of my dentist. It just so happens I had a conversation with her during one of my six-month regular exams, and she discovered, in addition to a chipped tooth, that I ran a podcast on religion, and then I discovered that her husband, Mark, happened to have recently written a book on some Jewish manuscripts. My end of the conversation sounded something like this.
Well, I found it really interesting, and I think it's going to have, like, I have a guest on my show. I get a copy of the book, I'll get a read.
Fortunately, Dr. Glickman understood what I said, and I was able to connect with a good rabbi, and here we are talking at the site of his Kol Ami congregation, which happens to be in a very interesting location, and I will be asking him a bit about that at the end of our discussion today. Mark, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you very much, Tony. It's a delight to be here.
Now, every time I leave your wife's office after a dental cleaning, I get sent back home with a goodie bag of toothpaste, floss, and a new toothbrush. So I don't suppose you're going to send me home with some priceless ancient Talmudic manuscripts today, are you?
You know, if I could get my hands on some of those, I don't know that I would give them up very readily.
Okay.
But you'd be the top of my list if I could share them at all.
That would be good. Although, once you saw my office, you probably wouldn't want to give them up to me because you see how messy I am. Although, that's what we're going to be talking today, essentially a messy storage place.
Exactly.
So I want to start out here with our discussion talking about the title of your book, and in specific, this whole Geniza thing. Until I picked up your book, I had no idea what a Geniza was. So what is it?
Well, the best way to describe a Geniza, I think, would be to call it a sacred document dump. A Geniza is a room in a synagogue, typically, usually an attic or a cellar or a closet sometimes, that acts as a repository for damaged and destroyed Jewish documents. If you have a Torah scroll that gets faded, or a Bible whose bindings falls apart, or a prayer book that you can't use anymore, Jewish law forbids you from throwing those documents away, ever.
That's because, and I found this out that was interesting in your book as well, is that the written word is very, very important in the Jewish religious tradition.
Exactly. Particularly the Hebrew written word, particularly the sacred texts of our religion, and especially the name of God. In fact, the prohibition from throwing away sacred texts began simply as a prohibition from throwing away any piece of paper upon which was written the name of God, and then it broadened from there over time. So a Geniza is a room where you dispose of, even though you're not really disposing of them, where you place these sacred documents that are very literally indisposable.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the sacred documents, that always takes on a, a special image in people's mind of something holy that you set aside. But when you were discovering or describing some of these genizas that are found throughout the world and in various synagogues, there's some mundane things that are thrown out in these things. I shouldn't say thrown out, that are put into these places as well.
Particularly in the Cairo Geniza, that's absolutely true. The Cairo Geniza held not only Talmud and Torah and rabbinic writings and all kinds of other sacred texts, but it held children's school books and love letters and medical prescriptions and business records and court documents. Why? Well, a few reasons. First of all, the definition of what constitutes a sacred document has expanded and contracted over the years. And in medieval Egypt, where this collection was amassed, the majority of the documents, by the way, come from the years 969 to 1250. That was the Geniza heyday, if you will. In medieval Egypt, in that time, there was a respect for and a cherishing of the written word in general. Anything that was written seemed to have something special, perhaps even something holy about it. That's one reason. The other reason is that even on sacred documents in medieval Egypt, there was a lot of God talk. If you were writing a letter to a buddy of yours about the woman you hope to marry, let's say, mm-hmm. and you said, you might begin the letter by saying, "To my dearest friend, Musa bin Maimun, may God's blessings be upon him." And then you tell the story, and all of a sudden you've got God's name on this document.
And it qualifies for the Geniza.
Exactly. Yeah. And on top of that, there was simply a lot of material. And so we can imagine scenarios in which, say, grandpa dies, and in his house, the grandchildren find a pile of old papers in the corner. And they pick it up, and they look at it. It's a sizable pile, and one says to the other, "Some of this stuff is probably sacred and probably should go into the Geniza. Do you want to go through it and pick out all the sacred documents? I don't want to do it. Do you want to?" And so they would just pitch the whole thing into the Geniza rather than very carefully sift through the content for its sacred material.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to get back to the Cairo Geniza here in a little bit because it is a very special one. It is very unique in a number of different ways. But in terms of just general Genizas, your Geniza space here in the United States. Do contemporary synagogues have these Genizas?
Often. I mean, typically, you have, when a document gets unusable, becomes unusable, you have two options. You can either bury it in the cemetery or you can put it in a Geniza. And usually, synagogues will let the Geniza pile grow and stew for some time until it gets sizable, and then they'll haul it out to the cemetery for burial. And many synagogues have shelf or a box or some sort of a container where they keep their sacred text, and periodically they'll bring them out to a cemetery.
So a lot of these things are just boxes. They're not actual specific rooms or, as you describe the Cairo Geniza, an attic or a separate antechamber.
Often it's a smaller place, yes. But there's some sort of a designated spot where those sacred texts go because they're treated specially.
Now, in the United States over the past century or so, there's been a split within Judaism, going conservative, reform, you got the Orthodox as well. Is this a specific practice that you find only in Orthodox, or does it affect reform and conservative Jews as well?
Certainly the Orthodox would be stricter about it, but even in reform congregations and certainly conservative congregations as well, I shouldn't say even, in all synagogues or in synagogues across the spectrum of religious observance, we see groups of Jews cherishing and not wanting to simply throw away their sacred documents. And so there are genizas at synagogues of every denomination.
Now, I don't want to signal anything in advance here about where your congregation, Kol Ami, meets, but both Kol Ami and Kol Shalom, do you have genizas? Do you use boxes? What do you do?
In both congregations, we have what I would call clutter. And at some point, once the clutter gets voluminous enough, then we go through and we sweep through and we do a cleaning and we figure out what to do with these documents. And in sometimes we'll send them to another congregation that has a Geniza of their own. We don't have any burial spots of our own, Geniza burial spots. There's also talk about starting a regional one in the Northwest as well.
Okay, so sharing Genizas is fine.
Perfectly kosher.
And does it have to be on the site of a synagogue, or can you have it at a special other designated site? Or?
Well, typically the Geniza itself, the Geniza room, is at the synagogue only because that's where the documents tend to gather themselves. And people will often bring documents from their home to the genizas at the synagogue. And then if you're talking about a burial site, typically that's at a cemetery. The custom is to have it be at a cemetery near the grave of a scholar, if possible.
And that's probably what my wife tells me. She sees my office at work, and she says, "You're going to be buried someday underneath all those books and clutter that you have." So, you know, maybe it's the documents being buried by you, or maybe it's the documents being burying me, I guess. So I don't know.
Well, you know, Tony, it's funny. I mean, you say that, and it's funny because people ask me, why do Jews hold on to these papers for so long? Why the obsession about this? And my answer to that is this. Any person who has ever looked at a piece of paper, whether it be a bill stub or a receipt or a letter of some sort, and said to themselves, I'm going to throw this thing away. I don't know. Maybe I should hold on to this thing. Maybe I'll need it. And then they set it aside. Anybody who's ever gone through that process, even if they've ended up throwing it away, anybody who's ever struggled with whether I should hold on to this scrap can understand what I like to call the Geniza impulse. We hold on to these papers because they connect us. They connect us to times and places beyond our immediate surroundings at the moment.
That's what I actually think is really interesting about some of the more mundane items in there. I mean, we're going to talk about some of the really cool findings that you have in the Cairo Geniza, but I was kind of fascinated by the fact that you mentioned there was a wedding certificate, and right below it there was a divorce certificate from the same couple, and separated only by a year or two. And you had a little funny thing in the book that said, whoops. And, you know, so the book, for you folks listening, the book is filled with a lot of interesting anecdotes and humor in it. So I urge you to pick it up. But yeah, it is those little mundane things that connect to. And I think back of my own office, which I might start now calling the Geniza of the University of Washington. There are things that I know I will never, ever read again or ever use, but they sit there on the shelf because I can't get rid of it. It's from a time and place back in my history where important things happened, and I don't know.
So. We hold on to those papers, to those words that are important to us. And my guess is that if somebody at any time, whether now or in the future, were to sift through the papers in your office, they would get a very good sense of who you are.
Yes.
And what's important to you because of the choices that you've made about the papers that you hold on to.
No, that's very true. It's a very archaeological or anthropological study that one could do. And again, that's why I like the mundane items as much as the very important ones. But I do want to move on to the very important finds that are in here, because this Cairo Geniza is a big deal. And it's in Egypt, and it's contained in something known as the Ben Ezra Synagogue. And the discoveries that were made in the Cairo Geniza, as it's become known, were mostly done in the last decade of the 19th century. Now, I use the word discovered somewhat loosely because people knew they were there, as we'll find out, but then they were kind of collected in the late 1890s. But before we get to that building, there's something that was surprising to me when I read this. The fact that there was a working synagogue in Egypt at that time. Now, did Egypt have a very big Jewish population a century or so ago? And who were these folks that were worshiping in the Ben Ezra synagogue?
One of the things that we now know, in part due to the contents of the Cairo Geniza, is that, yes, Cairo, for centuries, had a huge Jewish community. Thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of Jews lived in Cairo. They were successful. They often attained high-ranking government positions. They were successful merchants. They interacted closely with their Muslim neighbors. They became friends with their Muslim neighbors. Occasionally, there were even marriages between Jews and Muslims. Those were scandalous, but they happened. So really, for many centuries, there was a rich and thriving, vibrant Jewish community in Cairo. And that extended into the mid-20th century. With some of the developments in the mid-20th century, particularly the rise of the State of Israel, Cairo became a very unfriendly place for Jews to live. Not by Israel's fault, but simply because of the growth in anti-Semitism that was happening at the time. During the Nasser regime, there was a lot of oppression, and most of the Jews fled during the middle of the 20th century. And nowadays, sadly, this once thriving Jewish community consists of just a few dozen, mostly elderly, indigenous Egyptian Jews in Cairo. Mm-hmm.
Now, the Jews who were there in Cairo, say, in the 19th century or before then, or when these documents were being deposited in the 10th century, 11th century, 12th century, they were known as Arab Jews. Now, I'm familiar with the Ashkenazi Jews and the Sephardic Jews, and I've always thought that Sephardic Jews were Arab Jews. But in your book, you differentiate this. So you see three essentially branches of Judaism that were geographically located. Tell us about that.
Right. So if you ask most American Jews or most Western Jews today what the two what the major cultural subgroupings of the Jewish people are today, they will list Ashkenazic Jews, whose ancestry goes back to Germany originally and then throughout Northern Europe, and Sephardic Jews. Sephard is the Hebrew word for Spain, and these are Jews from Spain and Portugal and later Greece and other Mediterranean areas. But what we didn't realize fully, I mean, people knew that there were Jews in Arab lands before the 19th century, but many of the Western Europeans especially sort of looked down their noses at these people as sort of turban-wearing, camel-riding yokels. And what we didn't realize is that Judeo-Arabic culture was as significant as it was. Until the mid-20th century, for many centuries before that, the most widely spoken language amongst Jews was Arabic.
Hmm. See, that's interesting.
You wouldn't think it from reading the papers today.
I would not have, yeah.
What happened was that in 1492, all the Jews, 100,000 or more, were expelled from Spain. Many of them went to Arabic-speaking countries, and they set their feet down in these countries. And these were the Sephardic Jews who moved to Arabic-speaking countries. And they, to an extent, sort of overwhelmed the local Judeo-Arabic culture. So nowadays, we sort of unfairly lump people from Eastern societies, Judeo-Arabic culture, in with the Sephardic Jews. But really, we need to talk about three separate Jewish subcultures.
And that's really what is picked up here in the Cairo Geniza, that culture, because you mentioned 1492 is a very important point when we recognize it as when Columbus set sail, but it's when not only Muslims or the Moors were pushed from Spain, but also the Jews, and that it does kind of swamp the Jewish-Arab culture during that period of time. Bring it up to present day. Does the Ben Ezra Synagogue still exist, and is it still operational?
It very definitely exists. It is operational, although not as a synagogue on any regular basis. It is now there's a little bit of disagreement over who actually owns it, but for all intents and purposes, it's owned by the Egyptian government. It is open every day as a tourist attraction. The Geniza Chamber itself is not open, and very few people have actually been into that room, but the synagogue is beautiful. They restored it in the late 1990s, and it's magnificent. It's a magnificent place to see. It's in Fustat, which is the oldest part of Cairo. Actually, Cairo itself originated as a suburb of Fustat and then eventually grew and swallowed up Fustat itself. But it's a sight to see.
And you had a chance to visit it recently, right?
My son Jacob and I, we were there in early 2010 when Jacob was 15, and we, at the time, we thought we got permission to go into the Geniza Chamber.
Wow.
At the time, we thought we were the only ones who had been there other than local caretakers since 1911. It turns out that a few other people had, but not many, and nobody had ever taken any usable photographs of it. And so we got permission and were able to get into that chamber at the Ben Ezra Synagogue among the first visitors from the outside world in a century. And we took, as far as I know, one of the very first usable pictures of the room ever taken.
And it is published in the book. And one of the things that I really missed from the book, and this is not through your fault of in any way, shape, or form, but it's just the fact that no pictures were taken of this thing. In fact, there's an interesting story about these two women who supported this mission to go and find out what's in the Geniza Chamber. One was a photographer, but then she leaves her camera back at her hotel room. She forgets about it. And so you have to really describe what this Geniza Chamber is. And so you had the chance to see that about a year, 2 years ago. Give us a description of what the synagogue looks like, roughly how big it is, and what that Geniza Chamber looks like.
So as synagogues go, the Ben Ezra Synagogue is relatively small. It's about 30 by 60 feet. It's built in a basilical style. It looks a lot larger than it actually is when you go in, because it's just so grand, and they're beautiful, ornate paintings on the walls and chandeliers. As with most traditional synagogues, there is a section for the women to sit. Men and women historically would sit separately in the synagogue. Here, as in many others, the women would sit on the balcony. And so there's a balcony surrounding three sides of the room. And high up on the wall, on the left side of the front wall, above the women's balcony, there's a small 2.5 by 3 foot or so hole in the wall, accessible only by ladder from the balcony. And so we went up to that balcony. They put a ladder up. When we visited, they put the ladder up, and it turns out the ladder that they gave me was not adequate to the task. So when I first climbed to the top of the ladder, the bottom threshold of the entryway was at my chest. Mm-hmm. And my government escort said, "Well, go ahead." He said, "Can you jump?" And I was like, I couldn't. I said, "I'm not going to let this stop me now I've gotten so close." And I said, "Do you have a higher ladder?" I felt like I was on Jaws. You know, I think we're going to need a bigger boat. I think we're going to need a higher ladder. And while they were getting the ladder, I was looking into this dark entryway. I couldn't see a thing, but then I remembered that I had a flashlight on my keychain. So I shined the flashlight into the room and had the biggest surprise of my whole trip. In fact, we have this on video. The moment before the memory card on our camera runs out, I proclaimed, "There's no floor." Now, there was a floor, of course, but the floor, I had always thought, was right at or slightly below the level of the threshold. In reality, it was down about 15 or 20 feet. If I had jumped, now wouldn't that have been a story? I would have probably still been there. And so it is more, I describe it as an attic, but it's more like a silo. It's really big. It's about 12 by 12 feet and maybe 20 to 25 feet floor to ceiling.
Yeah, that's what the initial description that you give in your book makes. You use the word silo, so I'm thinking this very big room. You have a picture of it, and it's empty when you take the picture of it, so it just looks like a very large empty room.
Which is the only reason, by the way, excuse me for interrupting, it's the only reason that they let me in. If there were still antiquities there, I don't think they would have let me in.
Yeah, that's probably true. But it is kind of neat, again, being there at that historical moment, even though nothing is there, the stories that you tell in the book, the history of the quote-unquote discovery of this, or the rediscovery of this, or you just get a sense of somebody else being there at that time. That must have been pretty cool.
It was an unspeakable thrill. It was great.
Yeah, so pretty big, and I'm kind of amazed by it, because I did, when I was reading the book, I measured the dimensions of my den at home, and I have a fairly big den, but so it was about the dimensions of my den, and then bigger. So it's just, I think
taller.
It's important to understand that it was tall, and thinking of it in terms of a silo, is really big. Now, you took a look at it in early 2010, empty room. Your book focuses, or a significant chunk of your book focuses on when this scholar, Solomon Schechter, discovers or rediscovers or enters this chamber back in, I believe it was 1896. What does it look like to him?
We're not quite sure. He didn't really ever make any note of the height of this room. Our best guess, and scholars have sort of been struggling with this a little bit, is that the documents were simply piled so high in there that the height of the room, at least when he first entered, didn't make a difference, that he was actually standing on the Geniza pile. Mm-hmm. The sisters that you mentioned a little while ago, the ones who forgot their camera, when they first got there, they weren't feeling very well. They decided at first not to climb up into the chamber, but they describe watching the caretakers of the synagogue climb up the ladder, jump into the chamber, and hearing the documents crunching and crumbling under their feet as they were walking around in there, enough to make somebody like me squirm and cringe.
Because you're destroying valuable documents, or potentially destroying valuable documents. I think what's interesting about this, the dimensions that you give, this 20 foot room, 25 foot room, 12 by 12, 12 by 14, rather large room, and just stacked with documents after documents. Now, there's been some remodeling since this thing is done, so we're a little bit unsure about what the exact dimensions are, correct?
Well, we think that the remodelers left the Geniza alone, so it's okay. Probably pretty much the way it was.
So that's a lot of documents.
Right, and our best guess as to why they built it so big, and we know of other synagogues that have Genizas, and they're usually not so large. Our best guess is that in Cairo, the Jewish cemetery is clear across town. And so when they built the structure, that was there for the bulk throughout the Middle Ages. That was built in the 11th century originally. They probably, we think, built it with a geniza so large that they wouldn't ever have to bother with hauling the documents out to the cemetery. They could just let them pile up forever.
Yeah. Which probably was a good thing, because I can imagine in a cemetery when you bury this stuff, that tends to get lost forever or damaged more quickly.
Certainly for us, it's a good thing. Yeah. They did find a few documents at the cemetery in Cairo, but not many, and they weren't very important ones. The real important ones were found in the Geniza chamber itself.
Okay. So let's go ahead and back up the story 100, 150 years or so, because when I said that Solomon Schechter, quote-unquote, discovered the Geniza, he wasn't really the first person who stumbled upon it after centuries of it being buried. This wasn't quite the Dead Sea Scrolls story where a goat herder accidentally stumbles on some hidden caves and finds some jars of manuscripts. Instead, a fair number of people knew it was there. Indeed, before Schechter got there, they were remodeling the synagogue. And so it was more that the Geniza was like a neglected or abandoned shed that everybody knows it exists, but nobody really thought there was anything worthwhile inside, I guess. Is that an accurate analogy of things?
Yes, and to a very great extent, it was hidden in plain sight. There were some collectors, some manuscript dealers who had started to poke around in their the first person outside the community who took note of the size of the pile, of the Geniza pile, visited in the mid-1700s, and then nobody was there for another century or so. But by the late 19th century, the locals in Cairo were beginning to notice that these crazy Europeans were starting to show an interest in the junk in their Geniza. And so some of this stuff started to seep out into the manuscript market. Schechter may have even seen some Geniza manuscripts himself and not paid much attention. People assumed that the Ben Ezra Synagogue had a Geniza simply because it was a synagogue, and that's what synagogues have.
And so this guy Schechter, he, as you say, he may stumble across some of these documents without knowing it. He does know some of them, and he's heard some rumors about this. Tell us about who this Solomon Schechter guy was and how he becomes important to the story of rediscovering this document repository.
Solomon Schechter was a fascinating man. He was born in a shtetl in the mid-19th century, a little fiddler-on-the-roof-style town, Jewish community in Romania, into a Hasidic Jewish family, very observant family. And he was, from the time he was a young child, he was known as an Ilui, an enlightened one. He was a genius. And he, through a series of moves, both geographically and intellectually, to the West, first to Vienna, then to Berlin, then to London, then eventually to Cambridge, he became a modern, scientifically oriented scholar, specializing particularly in the analysis of old Jewish manuscripts. At the time that the Geniza chapter of his life unfolded, he was the only Jewish faculty member at Cambridge University in England. Mm-hmm. He was a professor. He was a reader in Talmudic. That was the title under which he was hired. And so he was beginning to make a name for himself at this time in this, from a Jewish perspective, very lonely town of Cambridge. He was beginning to make a name for himself as an analyst of these old Jewish papers when he stumbled across this find.
And so he's kind of an outcast in Cambridge. He feels a little bit, you know, different. He's doing great work. People, scholars are loving what he's doing. And he stumbles across a couple of these sisters, these old ladies, and the way you describe them, I kind of think of the ladies in Arsenic and Old Lace, but they're kind of adventurous old ladies. So tell us about how they enter his life. They're a little bit kind of outcast too. They're Scottish Presbyterians in Cambridge, which is high Anglican. And how does that story connect Schechter with the Egyptian Geniza?
Well, you're absolutely right. They too were outsiders, and perhaps that's why they were, the Schechters and this pair of couple of sisters were friends. The women we're talking about were remarkable women. Mrs. Agnes Smith Lewis and Margaret Dunlap Gibson, twin sisters, as you said, born in Scotland. Their family was very wealthy. They received a boarding school education where they excelled particularly in languages, and they developed an affinity for old manuscripts, kind of like Schechter did, although Schechter was particularly interested in the Jewish ones. And these women were nothing to sneeze at. Yeah. A couple years before this whole episode happened, they traveled to the monastery at the foot of Mount Sinai, which involved a 10-day camel trek across the wilderness, where they discovered one of the oldest known Christian Bibles in the world. And on May 13th, 1896, beautiful sunny day in Cambridge, Solomon Schechter and Mrs. Lewis, one of the sisters, were doing their errands on King's Parade, the main drag in Cambridge, and they bumped into one another. And Mrs. Lewis said, "Why, Rabbi Schechter, how nice it is to see you. It's funny, my sister and I were just saying that we should have you over sometime. You see, we've just returned from the Middle East, as you may know, and we purchased some manuscripts there. And we've been able to identify the majority of them, but a few of them continue to puzzle us, and we were hoping you could come over sometime and help us identify them." And Solomon Schechter said, "Well, of course, I'd be delighted to do that." Mm-hmm. So they said goodbye, and Mrs. Lewis continued on her errands. Schechter makes a beeline straight to their house. And soon Mrs. Lewis returned, and so the two twin sisters and Schechter sat down at the dining room table where, going through these documents, Solomon Schechter identified, to make a long story short, a page from the Book of Ben Sira, the original Hebrew mm-hmm. of the Book of Ben Sira, a book that had last been reported seen almost 1,000 years earlier. And some of these papers were marked as having come from Fustat, from this old neighborhood of Cairo, where Schechter, as you said, remembered that he had heard there was a big Geniza, and the rest, as they say, is history.
So this Ben Sira document, you get fragments of it, and the sisters had just, you know, picked it up by accident. And again, what's neat about the book is it's filled with all these little fortuitous twists and turns that lead us to this place. And I find that story interesting. So the book, again, tells that very well. But this Ben Sira document, I don't know anything about it. What's the big deal about it?
Ben Sira will be familiar, perhaps, to your Catholic listeners, because it's in Catholic Bibles, in the Apocrypha section of the Bible. It's also called Ecclesiasticus. But the version that's in Catholic Bibles came from Greek translations written centuries after the original had been composed. The original was written back in biblical times. It's a book of wisdom literature, similar in some ways to Proverbs. Parts of it, quite frankly, don't sound very Jewish. Ben Sira talks about how to behave at a Roman banquet. The author doesn't seem to like women very much. And for a variety of reasons, when it came time to decide what books were going to make it into the Hebrew Bible, Ben Sira didn't make the cut.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until Catholics centuries after put it in through the Greek version, put it in their Bibles, that it was preserved. But the last person to have reported seeing the original Hebrew was a man named Sadia Gaon, a prominent Jewish sage who lived in Babylonia, but he died in 952. And Schechter himself, a couple years before all of this unfolded, had been involved in this major academic controversy, a smackdown, if you will, with this other scholar who tried to poo-poo the significance of the original Hebrew of Ben Sira. It probably wasn't even originally written in Hebrew. It wasn't very important. And Schechter was all over that. He pounced on it, citing all of the mentions of Ben Sira in the ancient literature. But of course, all the arguments were theoretical because the book had long been lost to history,
yeah.
Or so they thought.
And this is very cool because being in academia, I know that there are these academic rivalries that you get. And when you stumble upon something like this, you get the proof. This could be really big here. So what does he do with this? I mean, it's like, whoa, it's a fragment. It's not the whole thing. So if there's a fragment, there could possibly be a lot more of this stuff. And essentially the chase is on, right?
So he that night, Mrs. Lewis and Mrs. Gibson and Schechter write to what would be the 19th century equivalent of some academic blogs, right? Some scholarly newsletters announcing their find. And immediately, librarians throughout Europe begin saying to themselves, the original Hebrew of Ben Sira, I wonder if we have any of that. And sure enough, within a few weeks, the librarian at the Bodleian Library in Oxford announced that they had found several more pages of the original Hebrew of Ben Sira, a few of which had come from the very same copy of the book as the page that Schechter had seen at Mrs. Gibson and Mrs. Lewis's dining room table.
Uh-huh.
And there's this there's also a very complicated backstory involving a shady Austrian count that was working for the Bodleian, who was also trying to get at the Genese at the same time. And they were both trying to get there simultaneously, and Schechter got there first, it turns out. He made the arrangements as quickly as he could. He got the funding together, and he, by the end of the year, he was in Cairo, and he was able to announce this amazing find.
And that's the Indiana Jones aspect of this whole story. You know, the rival academics searching for this missing treasure, and you have one or two puzzle pieces laid before you, and you can't reveal all the puzzle pieces that you have, because then that gives the other guys the opportunity to perhaps get on that plane first and find stuff.
And when Schechter announced the find, they were very careful not to say where it had come from.
Yes, and that's part of the story that really, again, resonated with me being in academia, because you tend to keep things very close to the vest when you first have them. You don't want anybody to steal your ideas or the empirical evidence that you might have for different stuff. So he gets funding for this. How does he get funding to head out to Cairo? Because he's never been, as you say, south of Italy before. And now he finds this cool document or possible fragments of a document. It might be in this place. We got to get going there, but don't want to announce it to anybody else. How does that take place?
Fortunately, Schechter was friendly with a Semitics professor at Cambridge named Charles Taylor, who was very wealthy. And Taylor provided the bulk of the funding, as well as some letters of introduction he needed for his trip. So with Taylor's help, he was able to get on a boat, sail to Alexandria, and then from Alexandria take a train down to Cairo, meet with the leaders of the Jewish community there, and get permission to see the Geniza.
So he's there. And he's there for, from what I gather from your book, about 5 or 6 months.
Is not quite that. He's there for several weeks.
Several weeks? Okay.
Yes.
It sounded like it was there longer. But he goes into the Geniza, and we've kind of discussed that. He, you know, he sees all these documents, steps on them, crunch, crunch, crunch.
Don't say that.
Okay, don't say crunch. He lightly glides over these wonderful documents. And he said, this is a big deal. We got to get these back here to Cambridge so that we can study them. Is there any hassle in doing that?
Well, first of all, the local Jews related to this material in some very different and sometimes contradictory ways. On the one hand, to them, it was just junk. They were surprised that these Europeans were interested in these. I mean, imagine if all of a sudden an army of scholars descended on your study to look at all the papers laying around there. They were just perplexed as to why they were interested in this. But of course, it was a potential source of income for them at the same time. On the other hand, they felt honored that Schechter, this very important European scholar, was interested in studying it. So when Schechter stepped out of the Geniza, he made a donation, a nice donation to the synagogue, and they told him he could take whatever he wanted to take.
Yeah, free labor. Somebody cleans out our attic.
Exactly,
yeah, that's cool.
Exactly. So he hired some assistants, and within the next few weeks, the Ben Ezra was this hub of activity with people coming in and out and then bringing documents from the Geniza down the ladder, off the balcony, down into to get packed up into boxes. And inevitably, it was inevitable that some of the material would seep out into the black market. And so then all of a sudden people were selling all these manuscripts. And when some people offered Schechter the opportunity to buy some of these manuscripts that he had been told should have been his from the get-go, he went apoplectic, and he was soon succeeded in getting that practice stopped. The Giblews, that's what they call Mrs. Gibson and Mrs. Lewis, the two sisters, they visited him there. They bought some of the stuff back from the black market so that they could go back to Europe as well. And he was able to pack up. He didn't take everything, but he took a lot.
How much?
I mean, well, he estimated he packed up the box in the documents that he decided to take in 8 what were called tea chests at the time, very large wooden crates. He estimated that he was sending back 100,000 manuscripts to Cambridge for further study. It turns out that he was way off. That the real number was closer to 190,000 manuscripts.
Wow, yeah, almost twice as much as
exactly.
He actually had anticipated. And you do have, again, a picture of of Schechter working in his Cambridge office or a Cambridge room with some of these T-chest boxes. They're big. They're big crates. They're not. They're not the ones we're used to that carry copier paper or something. These are big things.
And actually, the picture, which is an iconic picture of Schechter in the library studying these documents, if you look very carefully at the boxes, one of them says bananas on it. So I think those were other boxes into which the into which the documents had been transferred.
Yeah. Okay, so he gets back to these things with Cambridge. There must be a big buzz about this discovery, right?
There was. Soon after he got back, he was very scared that somebody would get into the documents before he got there. He couldn't go back. He couldn't accompany them back to Cambridge because he had promised his brother, his twin brother, who lived in the land of Israel at the time, that he would go there for a visit. Mm-hmm. So he had to send the documents back without him, but he left very explicit instructions that nobody was to touch them until he got back.
I can imagine that's just a nervous time. I mean, today we have FedEx tracking that we can take care of that kind of stuff, but you're a couple-week boat trip, and you're in one place and you're in the other.
Exactly.
Oh, boy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But miraculously, nobody tampered with them until he got it back. And people started to buzz immediately about this. And when he made when it became clear what he had found, or at least the magnitude of what he had found, people started coming all the time and visiting him, and he complains in some of his correspondence about how difficult it was to do his studying because people would come to visit all the time. But of course, whenever they would come to visit, he would really be in his element, and he'd show them around, and
right.
He was a real raconteur in that sense. So,
yeah. One last question before we get into the actual content of the documents. But again, thinking about taking this stuff out of Egypt, and this was 120 years ago or so, 110 years ago. And today, if you take antiquities out of some of these countries, that becomes a big problem of, who has ownership over this? Is it the first person who found it? Is the government where it was? Does the ownership issue become a big deal at that time or subsequently?
It really didn't. I mean, this was, this was the stuff in the attic of one of the synagogues, so it was pretty clear that the Jewish community owned it. The local Egyptian authorities really didn't care very much about a bunch of old Jewish papers. And the Egyptian authorities, even if they did, didn't have much power because this was the time when the British government ruled Egypt. And there was a British protectorate. I'm not sure if that's the right word. Schechter became friendly with the British governor of Egypt, Lord Cromer, who helped him expedite the shipment as well. So if there were any problems, Lord Cromer just greased the wheels so he could get back. So there was no real issue of bringing the stuff out. And this was a time, of course, when they were also bringing out mummies and all kinds of other antiquities, which that became an issue later, and rightly so. But at the time, nobody really complained. They were just, I think, flattered to be the subject of so much, or the object of so much interest on the part of Cambridge University.
Yeah, it's kind of a cool thing. So let's talk about the content. We already discussed the Ben Sira document. There was something else that was discovered early on in the process, and the discovery of what is in these nearly 200,000 documents takes a century, and it's still ongoing, really. But one of the early finds was something known as the Damascus manuscript. And what is that?
The Damascus document was one of the manuscripts that Schechter himself chose to study himself on his own. As he first began reading this, it was unclear to him exactly what this manuscript was. It was some sort of a rule book for an ancient breakaway Jewish sect of some sort, but he really couldn't figure out exactly what it was. But as he continued to study it, he realized that in the 8th century, he was able to piece this together, that in the 8th century, some travelers from Cairo went to the land of Israel. And they were poking around in some caves near Jericho where they found some clay jars, some canisters that had some papers in them. And they made some copies of some of these papers and brought them back to Cairo. So it turns out that what Solomon Schechter was studying was a very early copy of one of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah.
He didn't realize that it was one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, because the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves wouldn't be discovered for another 50 years. But sure enough, that's what it was.
So that's a pretty interesting discovery. So he spends a lot of time with that. Now, there was these other things, too, that you described, and I didn't know anything about this. But again, it's really archaeologically interesting. It tells us a lot about how things were done during the age and that. There was these things, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, the palimpsests?
Palimpsests.
Palimpsests. And I had to go look that word up, and I guess I should know it because I'm a big academic, and this is kind of a big academic-y word. But what were those things?
A palimpsest, by the way, I hadn't known this word until I began my research as well.
Okay.
But it is these palimpsests are fascinating documents. Today, we have paper readily available to us. It clutters up our homes, in libraries, papers line the walls. But in the olden days, in the Middle Ages, for example, paper wasn't always as readily available. So if you were a scribe and you wanted to write something out, you wouldn't necessarily have a nice fresh ream of paper from Staples or Office Depot to grab a sheet from. And you might have to figure something else out. One of the things you might do is take an already written on sheet of paper, erase it, and then write over it. But what you might not realize if you did that was that if that piece of paper were somehow to get preserved, like maybe in a Geniza or something, then over the years, the residue of the original ink that you thought you had erased would undergo a reaction with the ambient air and at least in part begin to come back. So what you'd be left with at the end was a document that had a darker, newer overcoat of text. Mm-hmm. And hovering faintly in the background would be almost like a ghost of an older text that somebody else had written that you very often could still read. And the Geniza had dozens of these. For example, there was a page of Talmud written in the 11th century over a 7th century translation of a Greek psalm. So what that means is that one day in the 1000s, a scribe went to write out this page of Talmud. What am I going to write it on? What am I going to write it on? Here, I'll grab this old thing. He grabs a 400-year-old psalm, erases it, and writes his Talmud over it, only to have that psalm come back, and it's sitting there hanging in the background now, even as we speak.
Yeah, which is very cool, because in many ways that doubles the number of manuscripts you have. Not everyone was written this way, but it certainly increases the number of manuscripts you have.
Yes.
It tells you, too, about, you get two layers of history there. It's almost like an archaeological dig where you dig down several layers of soil and you see something else there. I guess one of the questions, and this just popped into my mind, I understand the shortage of paper, though. Do you think there was some reluctance for scholars to do that? Because, as you mentioned before, the Jewish tradition considers the written word to be very sacred. You would think like, oh, I'm scraping off this written word.
Yes. Often the undertexts are in Greek and Latin, which was not sacred to Judaism.
Okay.
And so it's very interesting. When the 19th century scholars found these, the Christian scholars were often interested in only the undertext, and the overtext sort of got in the way. And nowadays, they're looking at both the newer and the older texts. But often, the undertexts were not Jewish documents, so the Jewish scribes didn't feel the same compunctions about using them.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's some of the other stuff that's been discovered in these Geniza texts over the past 100 years or so? What cool finds did we get?
Well, we've made all kinds of finds. First, Schechter himself identified several more pages of the original Hebrew of Ben Sira. So that text has reappeared.
Has it ever been the whole the complete thing?
I think there are now, and I forget the details here, there are three or four different versions of the original Hebrew, and I think some of them are, if not complete, at least almost complete. Some of them are very fragmentary. In the Geniza, there were children's school books. Can you imagine if a kid in a first grade class in a school in your neighborhood today were to learn that 1,000 years hence, somebody in some faraway land were to be studying their doodlings, their school books, what they would say. There were business records. There were court documents. Some of the very earliest personal checks were located in the Geniza. Whether they bounced or not, I'm not sure, but they were there. There was a plethora of medical material, medical prescriptions. Some of them were called for very exotic ingredients. One said, you begin by taking a lame and decrepit female hyena, and then it goes on from there. So there were biblical passages, some of which differ from the versions of the Bible that we have now. There were prayer books. There was poetry. And the list could go on and on and on.
Yeah, a lot of music was discovered. Also, some of the writings of Maimonides.
Maimonides. Yeah. Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, also known as Maimonides, was one of the greatest scholars in Jewish history. We should add that his day job was as a physician in the royal court of Egypt. So he sort of moonlighted as one of the greatest rabbis in history. And they had his handwritten documents there, the original copies in his own handwriting of some of his greatest works, some of his letters. We even have his trash collection receipts in the Geniza. And I started studying Maimonides when I was in high school. In college, I remember, in rabbinical school later, pulling my hair out, trying to understand what he was saying. I've since taught some of his texts. And to hold in my hand, as I had the opportunity to do in Cambridge and in New York, these pieces of paper, and to think that 800 years ago or so, was it 800, 1135 to 1200? Yeah, about 800 years ago, he sat down at a table and wrote this out, and now I'm holding it in my hands. I can't tell you what a great thrill that was.
Yeah, that is. It's whenever you see those historical documents, it's not just a sheet of paper, but there's the whole life behind it. You just to start imagining, as you said, Maimonides writing this down at a table and thinking about what the situation was when he did this. And it just, it transports you to another era, but it also connects you with that era.
Humanizes history.
Yeah, that's a good way, I think, of putting it. Schechter was at Cambridge for about another decade before he left. So he brings these things back 1896 and then actually shorter than that.
Five years.
1902. What happens to him?
Salman Schechter in 1902 was invited to become the president of the newly reorganized Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, which still exists to this day. It is the institution where conservative rabbis are trained. And they had some difficult years in the past. They reorganized the whole institution, and they invited him to come on as its president in 1902. So he, at that time, he moved to New York, where he lived until his death in the early years of World War I.
Now, this wasn't talked very much, and I don't know if you know this or if you can speculate on it. I mean, if you find something this big, right, this is a big discovery. You're excited about these new documents, the Damascus manuscript. Wow, this is really great stuff. But then you kind of leave it all behind. Did he leave it all behind? Did some of it go to New York with him? That must have been a really tough decision for a scholar to make.
He brought 100 or 200 documents with him to study that I believe they're still in New York. Maybe some of them got returned to Cambridge. It turns out that the Jewish Theological Seminary later in the 1920s acquired the largest private collection of Geniza manuscripts in the world. So now they have 30,000 to 35,000 of them on their own. But that was after Schechter was gone. Why did he leave? Well, he had studied these for 5 years. So he'd given this a good period of time. And at the time, the United States, the American Jewish community was booming. There were waves of immigration coming over from Europe, and it was clear that they would need rabbis to lead the community. So this was really a unique opportunity for Salman Schechter to lead in the training of a new generation of American rabbis to serve the American Jewish community. So you're right, the Geniza was an amazing and unparalleled opportunity for him at the time, but this was also the presidency of the Jewish Theological Seminary was a huge honor, and so he took it.
Yeah, and again, he got to take over a couple hundred documents, and pouring over that is going to take some time.
Exactly.
So one can imagine. Now we talked about when you held some of these documents in your hand and the experience that you felt at a very personal level, the discoveries that were made in the Cairo Geniza, and again, this has been studied by numerous scholars over the past century. It's still a continual process. They have a special institute at Cambridge to study these documents. Could you tell us a little bit about how that has connected back to Jewish practice? How has it affected the Jewish community, either locally around Cambridge or worldwide?
Well, in short, the answer is not very much, believe it or not. Despite the magnitude of this discovery, there are many people, including many educated Jews, who know little, if anything, about the Cairo Geniza. And the reason for that is understandable. By the time these documents were discovered in the 1890s, all the contemporary expressions, for the most part, of Judaism and Jewish life had been pretty much pretty well established, right? Orthodoxy knew what it wanted to do and knew what it was all about. And even if there were some, you know, alternate versions of Jewish law that appeared in the Geniza, I mean, that might be interesting, of some interest to them. But they had pretty much gotten their feet on the ground. Reform Jews, I mean, one of the things that the Geniza showed is that Jewish practice is dynamic. It wasn't always the same as it is today. There were Jews who used to do things a little bit differently. But Reform Judaism had already sort of proven that, so they didn't need the Geniza. Interestingly, just a few years ago, the Reform movement published a book called Mishkan Tefillah. It's the new prayer book that's used in Reform congregations around the country. And there is one prayer in there that had sat in the Geniza for about 1,000 years and was reprinted in this new Reform prayer book. One. I think our prayer book for our high holidays, or days of awe in the fall, also has one passage from the Geniza. But those are exceptions to the rule, and they're interesting. But there hasn't been a huge effect yet on Jewish practice.
And that was one of the things I found most interesting in the book. It came about halfway through the book, and it was the one place that really hit me hard, and I marked this. I go, well, and as thinking of this as a scholar as well, is that, oh, I'm doing all this work, I'm finding all this really neat stuff, and nobody cares. You know, there's that kind of that issue of, oh, and you do make an interesting point that, well, you know, everything was kind of settled by the time that this stuff came around. So people said, ah, this is not a big deal. Let's not worry about that. But here's what I want to bring it back to you. And you do a really nice job at this in the last two chapters of your book, is to give your general reflection on why this is important and why you wrote this book. Because, again, you know, a lot of Orthodox and Reform Jews and conservative Jews look at this and say, eh, you know, whatever. But you found it important enough to write about and the chance to reflect upon this. So what grabbed you about this project that you undertook, and why do you think it's important for us to really think about the Cairo Geniza in its larger historical context?
Well, thank you for your kind words about the book, by the way. There are a few reasons. First of all, it's just such a fascinating and exciting story. Mm-hmm. But more specifically, for one thing, you know, well, maybe the way to answer your question is to remember that everybody seems to know about the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Right.
Everybody's heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Very few people have heard of the Geniza. When I tell people that I'm writing a book about the Cairo Geniza, I typically would get one of two responses, either the blank stare or a heartfelt Gesundheit. In fact, the only person, the only exception, I think I mentioned this in the book.
Yeah, you do. Was, it's an interesting story.
Was I was having some minor knee surgery while I was writing the book, and they're wheeling me out into the operating room, and the nurses say, "What do you do?" I say, "I'm a rabbi, and I write a column for the newspaper, and I'm also writing a book." They ask me about what, and I said, you probably haven't heard of it. It's this thing called the Cairo Geniza. By that time, I'm in the operating room, and the anesthesiologist standing over me, the anesthesiologist with the mask in his hand, with the gas hissing out of the mask, says, "Oh, yes, a Geniza is a repository for damaged and destroyed Jewish documents. And the one in Cairo was a very important one." Then he starts to lower the mask. "Yes, a very important one indeed." And he put the mask on my face, and I never saw him again. Right? So, you know, why is it that so many people have heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but not the Geniza? Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls might have something to teach about Christianity, so that adds to its interest amongst the billion or so Christians in the world. But one of the reasons, I think, for Jews is that we Jews tend to look at Jewish history through the lenses of Israel. And this is an oversimplification of what I'm about to say, but to an extent, many Israelis, if they had their druthers, would have Jews everywhere see Jewish history as glory days in the days of King Solomon and King David, 2,000 years of darkness when we left the land of Israel, and glory days once again with the newly reborn state of Israel. And here in the Geniza, you see this thriving, rich, vibrant Jewish community that not only is outside the land of Israel, but is in Egypt of all places, the very symbol, the very embodiment of Jewish pain and suffering. So it doesn't fit the notion of this thriving Jewish community. And that's one of the reasons I think we might not have heard about it. But that, to me, is also one of the most powerful elements of the story. The picture that the Geniza paints of Jews and Muslims living together as neighbors and getting along. And I have to think that if they could do it back then, yes, I know it wasn't perfect back then, and yes, I know things are different today, but if they could do it back then, there's got to be a way for us to figure out how to do it once again today. It is a fascinating picture of the past, but also a hopeful picture of tomorrow.
And speaking of that, of getting along with your neighbors, I want to bring us again back to a contemporary times. And as I promised in the beginning of our podcast, we're meeting at your Kol Ami congregation, and it's in a unique space. And again, the Geniza is about space. It's about storing memories of scholarship and of ideas. And as you mentioned, it tells us about the world of Muslims and Jews getting along. But here contemporarily, your building, your congregation meets in a building that is regularly a United Methodist Church.
Right. Congregation Kol Ami is a small synagogue, and so we rent space from Bear Creek United Methodist Church in Woodinville, Washington.
And so, see, I find that absolutely fascinating because I am interested in property and space and how churches manage this. Tell us a little bit about how that relationship was created and how it's being managed today.
Well, it was created before I came on the scene here, and the synagogue was looking for some space, and the church congregation had just built this magnificent building, and they were looking for some renters, and it was a match made in heaven, I guess you could say, and they really value, at least that's what they've said, and I take them at their word. They treasure our presence here. As a matter of fact, even before our relationship was established, I should say it like this. When you come into the church building, as you're entering the sanctuary, you'll see that there are some etched glass doors leading into the sanctuary. And one of the etchings on the doors is of a Jewish star, of a six-pointed star. That star was here even before we began renting space here. This is a congregation that really treasures the opportunities that it has to reach across the various lines that otherwise might separate us and become friends with members of other faiths and religions.
Yeah, it's a theme that we've featured here recently on our podcast. And last week we talked with Alan Hertzke about religious liberty and how the pluralism in America has not necessarily led to religious conflict, although that's happened, but it really has led to an ecumenical understanding of across different faiths and traditions. And really, your congregation is living it. And as you say, the documents that we see in the Geniza gives us a different picture of what that entire history of religious relations has been, and as you say, what it can be in the future.
We shouldn't make any bones about it. Throughout history, some of the greatest enemies, if you will, the Jewish people have foisted horrible hatred, have carried out horrible acts of hatred upon us, often in the name of Christianity. And today, while there is some anti-Semitism that comes out of religious institutions, for the most part, Christians are our greatest friends, and we live in that sense in a golden age of ecumenical life here in the United States, of interfaith relations. I have served on the faculties of Pacific Lutheran University and of Seattle University, which is a Catholic university. Would that have happened 50, 100 years ago? I doubt it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. That's a story that we continue to tell here on Research on Religion. And we certainly have enjoyed having you on here. And again, your book is entitled Sacred Treasure, The Cairo Geniza, The Amazing Discovery of Forgotten Jewish History in an Egyptian Synagogue Attic. We'll link to that on our website, as well as check out our Facebook page and Twitter feeds. We would appreciate if you could spread the word around about us and get us to many different people of many different faiths. Rabbi Glickman, it's been a pleasure having you on.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for the invitation. I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.